Our next speaker, Jocelyn Smith, is also a PhD student in Asian Cultural Studies here at New Mexico University in her first year of study. Hey, Jocelyn.
Okay, so in this paper, I examine Kesha's musical performance as a disruption of heterosexual femininity. Through her music, both the lyrics and the distorted electric sounds, Kesha fails, and I am quoting Misha Cardenas here, to accept the moral duties of heterosexuality, instead opting to occupy the position of the sleazy, cheap slut. While I do not argue that this position is unproblematically feminist, I see a space for Kesha's music and J. Jack Halberstam's formulation of Gaga feminism as, quote, a feminism built around stutter steps, hesitation, knowing and unknowing, embracing your darkness, a feminism that does not find comfort in assimilation, but demands resistance and transformation. I also see a space for Kesha within the feminism espoused by Donna Haraway in her Cyborg Manifesto. Haraway argues for feminisms built or weaved around the cyborg, which she defines as, quote, a cybernetic organism, a hybrid of machine and organism, a creature of social reality as well as a creature of fiction. Kesha's feminism exists at the intersection of Gaga and cyborg, in the fragmentation of identity and the body, and in the process of weaving something new that transgresses the boundaries of straight and queer, femme and butch, animal and machine, organic and technological, and intoxication and sobriety. So by going Gaga, by breaking down boundaries between animal, human, and machine, Kesha attempts to reclaim the space of the drunk slut in popular music, a space most often claimed by men who, oh so chivalrously, attempt to save the emotionally damaged, drug-addled, and sex-addicted girl from herself. Unlike artists such as Kelly Clarkson, who, in her song I Do Not Hook Up, denies this helpless drunk slut subject position through sobriety and abstinence, Kesha reclaims this space by imposing her own timeline on her drunk sluttiness. As Misha Cardenas argues in her essay Blah 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 Kesha Feminism, and I quote, although Kesha embraces an excess of embodied pleasure, she refuses to be sexualized on demand. Kesha decides when and where, and most importantly, if her panties drop, as she asserts in her song Grow a Pair, and she'll call you when and if she needs a hit, as the lyrics of See You Next Tuesday insist. And I argue that Kesha denaturalizes the male as sexual aggressor, female as passive recipient binary by distorting her voice and pushing her sound to its extremes. So when I was in the beginning stages of thinking through this paper, I toyed around with the word queer as opposed to disruption or distortion. However, I decided that was not my argument. Kesha embodies, I want to suggest, an extreme heterosexuality instead of queerness, but to be clear, not necessarily in opposition to queerness. By pushing heterosexuality to its limits, she defamiliarizes or makes strange heterosexuality, doing the work that Halberstam argues he was doing when he changed his approach to teaching Introduction to Gender and Sexuality from the, and I quote, try to be tolerant of these weirdos approach showcasing queerness to the how weird is that approach to heterosexuality. I argue that Kesha's intoxicated heterosexual femininity works to denaturalize and distort the position of the drunk slut. Also, I suggest that Kesha's distortion of the drunk slut allows her to occupy a male space in her music. That is, she, with her blatant heterosexual femininity and sluttiness, does not become male, but forcibly takes up space within heterosexual masculinity and bro culture. So as I stated at the beginning of this paper, this occupation is not unproblematically feminist. Often, the reclamation of the word slut in the attempt to become one of the guys leads to the internalization of individualist narratives of empowerment and the compliance with one's own objectification. However, while I do not argue that Kesha is immune to male objectification and exploitation, I do want to suggest that something more complex is happening in her music, and that it is a disservice to Kesha and the radical Gaga gender politics she embodies to view her only as anti-feminist or faux feminist. Cardenas argues, quote, to see Kesha as not political, in contrast to the politics of other artists, is to participate in the delegitimization of certain subject positions, denying their agency, and potentially not seeing the radical visions of political possibility they offer. So can we not see agency and radical visions of political possibility in the drunk slut? Can we not see young, intoxicated, sexually promiscuous women as potentially political, as participating in some Gaga gender fucking of their own with Kesha as their queen? This may seem a bit idealistic, but as Cardenas argues, and I quote, "By considering the possible political readings of Kesha, I am engaging in the task of taking femmes seriously and seeing where that leads." Similarly, a related study might be made that takes Amy Winehouse's music seriously, and thus sees her death from alcohol poisoning not simply as ironic, a joking connection made by many, but as deeply rebellious in the spirits of poets of intoxication, such as Charles Baudelaire and Henry Miller. So can we not then understand Kesha's drunk, slutty occupation of heterosexual male spaces as deeply rebellious, maybe not so much in the spirit of poets of intoxication, but in the spirit of sexually promiscuous, substance-abusing bros, male rock stars, and male hip-hop artists? So I want to begin my analysis of Kesha's music by playing most possibly the most well-known Kesha lyrics ever, apparently by young children as well. So I'll play that now.
Wake up in the morning feeling like P. Diddy.
Hey, what up,
grab
girl?
My glasses, I'm out the door. I'm gonna hit this city.
Let's
before
go.
I leave, brush my teeth with a bottle of Jack. Cause when I leave for the night, I ain't coming back.
Okay, so lyrically, these first four lines of TikTok align her, first of all, with P. Diddy, a black male rapper and entrepreneur infamous for his extravagant parties, expensive alcohol, and womanizing. But, she clarifies, she's not nearly as classy as P. Diddy. She just wakes up feeling that badass. She brushes her teeth with a bottle of Jack, which, aside from sounding absolutely disgusting, gives her a kind of white trash aesthetic. Finally, when she claims, "When I leave for the night, I ain't coming back," she implies either that she will be drinking and dancing all night, or she's gonna find some dude to fuck and not come home until the morning. So somehow, in just four lines, she's presented herself as badass, extravagant, trashy, and slutty, and somehow in complete control of it all. I argue that she demonstrates this control through her vocal style, which Cardenas calls Kesha's white girl rap. Rapping in hip-hop music is often seen as the domain of men, whereas women more often sing. Singing is softer and prettier and therefore more feminine, and rap can be ugly and forceful. It is common in hip-hop and rap music for men to rap the verses and women to sing simple choruses as accompaniment. Kesha herself was that woman in Flo Rida's song Right Round. In a Billboard article, Kesha explains that she got the dollar sign tattoo on her hand because she was being ironic. She says, and I quote, "I didn't make any money off the Flo Rida song. No one knew it was me. Whatever. I'm money. I don't need money." She wasn't credited for the song, and she refused to appear in the video. So perhaps in defiance against this, or to demonstrate how she really is money, Kesha raps the verses and sings the choruses in the majority of her songs, and her rapping style is aggressive and dominating. So some may argue that her obvious use of auto-tune, specifically on the phrases "hit this city and ain't coming back" from the example we just heard, demonstrates that she cannot rap or sing and does not have control over her own voice. However, I argue that you could also read her blatant auto-tuning as a way of demonstrating control over her voice. If she cannot make the sound she wants naturally, she will make it happen through other means. This relationship between technology and popular music is not new. Barbara Bradbee argues that technology has been incorporated into rock and pop music, but that ideologically, technological expertise in music and otherwise is equated with masculinity. So the computerization of music over the last few decades has worked to exclude women and girls from pop production, and Kesha's complex work with technology in her music has worked to alter this narrative. In addition, as Haraway argues, quote, "Who controls the interpretation of bodily boundaries is a major feminist issue. Kesha, by pushing her own voice beyond its natural ability, defines the boundaries of her own body." So while autotune is often dismissed as merely a crutch for those who can't sing, I argue that Kesha's use of this technology as a tool of bodily extension, as opposed to a mask or a cover-up of her body and voice or something that she depends on, allows us to think of her auto-tuned white girl rap as a manifestation of the cyborg voice, to put it in Haraway's terms. It's an attempt to distort and disrupt the gendered relationship with technology in pop and hip-hop music. But Cardenas also suggests that, quote, "Kesha's appropriation of rap as a mode of singing that requires little or no talent demonstrates a misunderstanding of rap through Kesha's own white privileged subject position." So while Kesha's appropriation of rap is demonstrative of her use and abuse of her own white privilege, her white girl rap is also emblematic of her going gaga and distorting what is appropriate within certain genders in certain genres. Not only is Kesha's lack of vocal virtuosity and her use of autotune unfeminine, as I have said, It is also a disruption of the hip-hop genre, as Kesha takes up space within the genre but refuses to play the game and become authentically gangster, as, for instance, P. Diddy had to do to become successful within the genre. Instead, she occupies this space with her cyborg voice and a punk-esque refusal to train her voice to fit within the already existing rules of genre and gender. As Halberstam argues, quote, Gaga feminism is a scavenger feminism that borrows promiscuously, steals from everywhere, and inhabits the ground of stereotype and cliche all at the same time. And it wants to incite people to go Gaga, to give up on the tried and true, the real and the authentic, the proven and the tested, and instead encourages a move toward the insane, the preposterous. So yes, Kesha's appropriation of rap is problematic, but it also opens up a space for femmes to, at the same time, embody their stereotype and steal from their opposite. It allows Kesha to be bad, both in a bad girl breaking the rules kind of way, and in a she's actually a really bad rapper kind of way. Her lack of talent isn't just about demonstrating her ordinariness, but about going Gaga, about giving up on the tried and true singing styles for femmes within her genre, and about occupying a male space by moving towards something unfeminine, preposterous, and a little trashy, or maybe something a little sleazy, which is the title of another Kesha song that I think illustrates the points that I'm making here. I'm gonna play you a little bit of that song as well.
Get sleazy, 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 get sleazy.
Again, is using her white girl rap singing style, and auto-tune is again highlighted. But it's really the lyrical content of this particular song that I think is more interesting and more Gaga. Kesha is drunk sluttiness in this song, but she uses the position of the drunk slut to reject the advances of a rich man. As she raps in the verse I played for you, you can't imagine the immensity of the fuck I'm not giving about your money and manservant and the mansion you live in. And later on, sick of all your lines, so cheesy, sorry daddy, but I'm not that easy. She also, in the chorus, rejects his brand new Benz and his bougie or bourgeois friends. She may be the drunk slut, but she decides who she is a drunk slut with, and she sure as hell isn't a gold digger. This embodiment of the drunk slut who exercises choice may seem antithetical or preposterous or outside of the tried and true, but as Cardenas argues, quote, her embrace of an excess of embodied pleasure is not in contradiction to her ability to deny sexual advances, but is a rejection of the system of male entitlement that rationalizes sexual violence as an unfortunate but acceptable norm. Here, she is using the position of the drunk slut to challenge misogynistic heteronormativity. Instead of promoting the message that sluts say yes, Kesha asserts that hell yeah, sluts definitely do say no, especially if you're a rich douchebag who's only using his money to seduce her. And, as she implies later in the song, would likely only judge her and her friends for their trashy behavior. She raps in the second verse, me and all my friends, we don't buy bottles, we bring them. We take the drinks from the table when you get up and leave them, and I don't care if you stare and you call us scummy. In addition, she asserts that she'd much rather be a slut for the music than for a douchey rich guy. After the second chorus, Kesha raps, rat-a-tat-tat on your dum-dum drum, the beat's so fat, gonna make me come, And then she adds, much too late, over to your place. So Cardenas also notes that, quote, in numerous songs, Kesha avoids expressing love for men and instead only focuses her affection on music. This adds ambiguity to her sluttiness, as the line I mentioned earlier from TikTok, where she claims that once she leaves for the night, she ain't coming back. Is she out dancing or having sex with strangers? Is she staying out for the music or for the men? The song Party at a Rich Dude's House presents a similar ambiguity. She says in the second verse, "No, we're not on the list. Come on, let's do it. No, we don't give a shit. Come on, let's do it. Dance till your pants come off. Come on, get naked." And in the third verse, "I wake up in the front yard. We don't care. Wine stain on the sofa. We don't care. I throw up in the closet and I don't care. Because we're young and we're broke and I can't find my coat." So here she's using and abusing this rich dude. Although her pants come off and she urges everyone to come on, get naked, she says this in the context of dancing. So again, is it the music she finds erotically stimulating, or is she having sex with the rich dude to distract him from the fact that she puked in his closet? Either way, she seems to be pulling the strings in the situation. So despite Kesha's sexually explicit language and her repeated demands for people, usually in public, to remove their clothing, she rarely describes any literal physical or sexual contact with men. For example, in the song Steven, she laments the fact that Steven, her object of affection, will not call her. Yet throughout the song, Kesha seems unsure what she would do if she actually got Steven. The only reason she wants him, she says, is because he's the only guy who has ever resisted her charms. The lyrics go, "I've got it down to a simple art. Just bat my eyes like this and there's a broken heart. But somehow you've turned the tables. What the hell? I can charm the pants off anyone else but you." So he's a challenge, a sick obsession, but not necessarily a love interest. And her idea of a relationship with Steven is to, and I quote, "keep you as my pet to play with and hide under my bed forever." So that's not exactly a normal heterosexual relationship. Kesha, like Haraway claims all cyborgs are, seems, and I quote, "suspicious of the reproductive matrix, and instead dreams of community not modeled on the organic family. She," and I'm quoting Haraway again, "is a creature in a post-gender world. She has no truck with seductions to organic wholeness." And Kesha demonstrates this through her inability to follow through with organic heterosexual reproductive sex, and through a desire for other kinds of community. In her song, "We Are Who We Are," Kesha calls for a unified we to go hard, just like the world is ours, we're tearing it apart, we are who we are. This radical community is not based in biological families or sexual reproduction, but in common desires and a need to reclaim the world as ours. And this refusal to participate in organic reproduction does not go unnoticed by fans in the popular media. Jenna Marbles, a very popular YouTube vlogger, in her imitation of Kesha says, and I quote, "When I was born, I was covered in glitter and I ate my own placenta. And I actually came out of my mom's butthole, which was cool and different. Vaginal birth is for people who want to play by the rules." So this is obviously an exaggeration and not necessarily the most academic source, but I think it solidifies my point that Kesha, through her construction of the cyborgian self, and I quote from Haraway again, is uncoupled from organic reproduction, even in the eyes of her fans. And I really didn't think I would quote Jenna Marbles and Donna Haraway in the same sentence, but I just did. Okay, so in addition, Kesha does not only avoid organic reproduction with men, but she also uses blatantly misogynistic, transphobic, and homophobic language to insult straight men in her music. So I'm going to think about how these moments of misogynistic language are another way Kesha occupies a male space in her songs, as she turns language that is usually used to denigrate the drunk slut against the straight man. For instance, in "Grow a Pair," she expresses frustration with a man for acting like he has a vagina, which infuriates me for a lot of reasons, but just bear with me for a second. She's flipping this narrative where a guy hooks up with a drunk slut and then finds out she has emotions and wants a relationship and then blames it all on her vagina right on its head. She distorts heterosexual femininity here by occupying the male space and turning the narrative around. And this distortion is quite literal in the song too, and I'll play you a really short bit of that song. Bitch. You should know. So when she attempts to show her compassion and more feminine side in the song and sings, "And you should know that I love you," a lot, the end of each high note is heavily distorted, as if she just can't get this feminine expression of love out naturally. What is natural to her, for better or for worse, is not being able to date a dude with a vag. So similarly, in the song See You Next Tuesday, Kesha, instead of singing about how hurt she is and how much she cried when she found out the guy she was dating had a girlfriend, she sings to him, See You Next Tuesday, and she spells the title of the song like that, so she's not being any more subtle than I am. So once again, she turns language that is often used against drunk sluts, against straight dudes, who were usually the ones calling drunk sluts names like that. In addition, she also comments in the song that, yeah, he might be a See You Next Tuesday, but she'd still hit that if she got bored. Finally, and was perhaps her strangest song, and that is saying a lot, she talks about how her fame has made her so badass and so huge that the boys she used to want to date are like snack food to her now. So she raps, I think you're hot, I think you're cool, you're the kind of guy I'd stalk in school, but now that I'm famous, you're up my anus, now I'm gonna eat you, fool. Your little heart goes pitter-patter, I want your liver on a platter. Use your finger to stir my tea, and for dessert I'll suck your teeth. Be too sweet and you'll be a goner, I'll pull a Jeffrey Dahmer. So his reference to Jeffrey Dahmer, who raped, dismembered, murdered, and ate men, pushes her occupation of the violent male space to an incredibly uncomfortable extreme, and functions as a disruption of the figure of the female man-eater often referenced in popular music. And most importantly, I think it illustrates my point that she distorts heterosexual femininity to the point where it's no longer normal or comfortable or easy to understand. So in conclusion, I hope that I have shown how Kesha can be taken up as a gender-fucking gaga feminist radical because of the way she distorts, disrupts, and denaturalizes heterosexual femininity and proposes alternative, if preposterous, modes of heterosexual intimacy. As Halberstam argues, quote, Gaga feminism proposes that we look more closely at heterosexuality, not simply to blame it for the continued imbalance of the sexes, but to find in its collapse new modes of intimate relation. And I think Kesha does just that. However, her embrace of darkness and unconventional ways of revolting can sometimes seem to be at odds with feminist thought. As Cardenas argues, quote, Kesha's urging the audience to be yourself unapologetically, fucking always, may be a call for its members to each take up the production of norms, beyond individualism, into a mode of being unapologetic that can be seen to be at odds with participation in social movements such as feminism. And yet, this unapologeticness and deconstruction of norms and individualist narratives is not at odds with feminist thought at all. Kesha, I have argued, is tension within feminisms. Thank you.
I sort of feel better about my question. I'm sure there are some questions. Yes.
Really, a question more of a comment. All the songs that you're referencing, Cannibals, Next Tuesday, and everything, all from the Animal Records. And Kesha, the Warrior record, kind of changed up her musical style quite a bit. There's a lot more rock collaborations with the Strokes, with the Bob, with Black Keys, and Flaming Lips on there. She kind of has sort of rebranded herself as someone who sort of straddles this sort of indie rock kind of line. And I just wonder how that plays into this whole idea of distortion.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and it's something that I didn't touch on here at the Warrior album, just because it was so different and I wasn't really sure how to incorporate it, but something that I do want to look at more broadly. But I think that it doesn't necessarily contradict what I've been saying, because I think that even as she is moving more into rock, she's still doing very similar things within she's still distorting the genre and disrupting it in very similar ways. But that's the titles of the albums too, which you brought up, is something I really want to get into with Animal and Cannibal and Warrior. There's something really interesting happening there that I really want to explore in more depth. And also that genre change, I think, is really important and something I do want to get more into as I expand this paper and work more on it. Thank you.
You've done a really good job examining this idea of Kesha performing a sense of agency in her performance and her image. How do you reconcile the fact that her music is the work of collaborations with big name male Svengali producers, mostly Dr. Luke, but also Max Martin and Shellback?
Yeah, that's yeah, she's definitely made some interesting comments too about those sorts of things. Like she'll say that she was forced to do something if someone criticizes her, and then she'll backtrack and say, no, I wrote that. And it's sort of this weird, she tries to have ownership over a sort of certain stuff, and then when it doesn't suit her, she doesn't want to. And it kind of I kind of like that in a weird way, that she's just like, she wants to own things in a certain way, and if she doesn't like it, she doesn't want it anymore. And I think that that's really interesting. But I think, yeah, there's definitely a lot of really problematic things that I didn't touch on as much in this paper, because I really wanted to think about the ways that she's occupying these spaces in a more positive way, because I think she's been just sort of, everything's been super negative about her. And yeah, that relationship is definitely really weird, and the way that she plays out that relationship is really weird too. And I feel like I could like write books on this or something.
I think that this is not uncommon, obviously, for pop musicians, you know, for especially for young women to, and people talk about producers, and, you know, the idea of where is their agency, and it always comes back to this idea that, well, it's just because she's full of contradictions, we don't have to believe in her and what she has to say. And I think that's very problematic and something that lots of people have done over and over again with lots of people, Madonna, for example, and stuff like that. But one of the questions that I really wanted to ask is, I believe, I totally buy your argument, I'm really happy to hear this, but my question is, sometimes this extreme that she's going to is another another trope, another characterization of women, that the spider, right, that we're trying to, especially looking at Cannibal, or even how she sort of takes in and spits out men, how she has this kind of sexual, she is in control of this, etc. And so it's sort of another archetype or another stereotype of women, and I'm wondering if you could speak to that, because that would be something that could easily be challenged, I think, through your work, but you didn't do it here, so just
right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't want to also say that, like, I think that everything she does is wonderful and just, like, explodes everything, but I think that she occupies these stereotypical spaces in a way that she pushes it so far that suddenly you become very uncomfortable with the stereotype. I think the man-eater thing is definitely a big part of that. Like, you have, you know, Nelly Furtado saying she's a man-eater and it's hot and it's, you know, whatever, and then you have Kesha saying this sort of stuff and you're like, whoa, what happened there? Maybe it can make you, you know, go back to what was happening with those other artists and say, okay, maybe this is, like, make you think more about the stereotype and what's involved in that, if that, but I just, yeah, again, it's something I need to think more about, but yeah, and I think just to speak again to the first point that you were talking about, I think it's interesting that even if maybe it can be argued that she doesn't have agency in certain ways and that the producer relationships are quite controlling, that she performs agency regardless, and I think that's really interesting. Thanks. I got a thumbs up.
Yeah, I'm really struck. I mean, I actually feel like I need to listen to a lot more Kesha now. but I'm really struck by this trope of women embracing slutiness and the grotesque. And I'm thinking about this in like Lady Gaga's telephone video. And also I was thinking about Lena Dunham's Girls, which I think has also had, I mean, obviously taking a very different sort of class orientations, but about the ways that the depictions of sexuality and choice and agency and the, you know, the grotesque and the awkward in 20-something white female identity is taken up. And critiqued, I think, for many of the ways of, like, you know, the ways that Brooklyn has been sort of whitened in this thing. But in Lena Dunham's case, of course, one of the things that we, you know, that's always going back to the defender is that here she is as a producer and a writer who has a lot of power, obviously because of the cultural and economic capital that she gets to bring to bear on this. And I don't know, I wonder if you can sort of, you know, not just, I mean, I think the agency question is a critical one, but can you reflect a little bit more on the sort of squeamish and shock response to this expression of heterosexual, I mean, particularly white, but I mean, obviously more broadly, female sexual agency that we're seeing in sort of popular culture?
Like, you just like made a light bulb go off with that girls thing. I was like, oh my God, I start taking notes everywhere. But yeah, I think that's really interesting and something that I didn't include in the paper, but I feel like I've talked about to everyone I've talked to this paper about, is this photo that Kesha tweeted of herself squatting and peeing on the side of the road. And this sort of like, and Lena Dunham does some like not quite that extreme, and I think there's like definitely a class dimension to what Lena Dunham does versus what Kesha does. And an educational thing, I think, too, is part of it. I mean, Lena Dunham's performing this sort of higher education where I think, I don't know that much about Kesha's educational background, but she's performing a sort of lower brow, I don't know what I'm saying anymore. But yeah, I think that this sort of, both with Lena Dunham and with Kesha, there's sort of this bringing in of the gross. You see them in the bath, you see them going to the bathroom, this whole sort of, this new element of, yeah, sorry, I'm just really excited about what you said, but I don't have an answer.
So transgressive, and I think, like, shocking things that young heterosexual women are getting up to, I think there is, like, you know, I guess just to use the phrase pearl clutching, you know, by the culture, like they're hooking up. It really just, I mean, I think it's a really interesting moment for, you know, female heterosexuality.
Yeah, and the role model conversation that happens around these figures that you don't want your kids watching girls or listening to Kesha, because you don't want people, if you think it's a really interesting moment, at the same time, you're like, I don't want people to act like that on a daily basis. I don't know about that, but.
Great, thank you, Jocelyn Wilson.